Leader!
Order, order.
Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you the Week in Parliament with Tom Frewen and Rhys Lyon. 3 days to go before Easter and the start of a long adjournment taking in Anzac Day. MPs will not be back in the chamber until Tuesday, April the 28th, starting at 2 with question time. This week's start, however, was set back by a half an hour, as Rhys Lyon reports.
Tuesday in the House started with MPs marking the passing of two former Prime Ministers of Australia and Singapore. Deputy Prime Minister Bill English began the tributes to former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser.
Mr. Speaker, I move that this House express its sadness at the passing on the 20th of March of former Australian Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Malcolm Fraser, ACCH, GCL, aged 84. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Fraser served his country with distinction as Australia's 22nd Prime Minister from 1975, when he was appointed in a caretaker role following the shock dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam by the Governor-General. This was arguably the most dramatic day in Australia's political history. Mr. Fraser went on to win the following three elections and served as Prime Minister until 1983.
Paying tribute from the other side of the House was Labor leader Andrew Little.
I just rise briefly to support the motion and to acknowledge and to record the New Zealand Labor Party's condolences at this time, the loss of Malcolm Fraser, and note that Malcolm Fraser was elevated to the role of Prime Minister of Australia in arguably the most controversial of circumstances, but he acquitted himself in that post until he was succeeded by Bob Hawke. And it was his post-prime ministerial and post-parliamentary career that I think he will be most remembered for, certainly on this side of the House. He led the Eminent Persons Group on behalf of the Commonwealth Heads of Government to inquire into apartheid in South Africa. And he was very much a part of the diplomatic process of leading the change externally that subsequently led to a genuinely free and democratic South Africa that saw ultimately the election of Nelson Mandela as president in the 1990s.
Andrew Little. And after representatives from other parties had paid their respects, Bill English was back to mark the death of former Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew.
I move that this House express its sadness at the passing yesterday of Singapore's first Prime Minister, the Honourable Lee Kuan Yew, GCMG, CH, age 91. As one of Singapore's founding fathers, Mr. Lee led Singapore to independence in 1965 and remained its Prime Minister until 1990. Due to his unwavering determination and vision, Mr. Lee guided Singapore's growth and development, making it the world leader among small countries that it is today.
Next to speak was Labour's Phil Gough, who remembered a meeting he had had with the former Singaporean leader.
When I had dinner with Lee Kuan Yew at the Shangri-La Dialogue in 2008, I explained to the then mentor minister that my mother was a great admirer of his. And he looked at me somewhat quizzically and said, why would that be the case? And I explained that in 1977, as a student, having gone 6 years without a haircut, passing through Singapore, I was given my first haircut by the customs officials at the airport as the price of entry. And my mother congratulated him on achieving something that nobody else had been able to do for years before that time. Mr. Speaker, there are aspects of Lee Kuan Yew that all of us would immensely admire. He turned a third world country into a first world country with a higher per capita standard of living than we enjoy in this country. He dealt effectively with corruption. He built a first-class education system. He transformed the living standards and grew the GDP of that country 15 times between 1960 and 1980. There was, however, another side to Lee Kuan Yew, which he himself admitted when he was being interviewed in 2010, and that was that he was a very authoritarian figure. He locked up his opponents and he cracked down on the media. And he admitted that he had done some bad things in his time. And that was the other side that, if we were to be fair in our memory of Lee Kuan Yew, that we would also acknowledge. But today in particular, we remember him as a man who was a strong leader, who gave Singapore an influence totally disproportionate to its size and created a better country for his fellow countrymen and women.
The final tribute came from the ACT Party's David Seymour.
Lee Kuan Yew was an extraordinary man who ruled in a constitutional arrangement I suspect very few, if any, in this House would have a lot of patience or support for. And undoubtedly, at times, he did misuse his and abuse his power at the cost of what we would regard as normal civil liberties. But all of that is only a preamble to tributing what he did for Singapore, a country that in the 1960s was a recipient of foreign aid from New Zealand, and today has twice the GDP per capita that we do. And it's not only a tribute to the great man Lee Kuan Yew, but also the approach he took to open markets, free trade, flexible labour markets, and tolerable taxes that have allowed the people of Singapore, who had no natural resources to speak of, to become so prosperous.
And it's likely that it is many of those people of Singapore who have viewed our YouTube video of the tributes more than 330,000 times, easily our most viewed video yet. The video features tributes to Mr. Lee from all parties and can be seen on our YouTube channel, Parliament Today. There's also a video of the tributes to Malcolm Fraser, along with many other highlights from the chamber.
Thanks, Rhys. Now, as Tom Frewen reports, Wednesday's question time was also delayed by more speech-making, this time on a more cheerful topic, very much on everyone's mind, including that of Speaker David Carter.
I've got a very good mind to ask that member to leave the chamber, but I won't because he'll get an advantage on the rest of us to actually watch the cricket.
That member was the New Zealand First Party's Dennis O'Rourke, who stayed in the chamber where MPs can follow the cricket on their laptops, tablets and smartphones, a far cry from the days when cricket was on the radio, and so were they. Up until the late 1990s, cricket shared the old YCAM network with Parliament, which had precedence, causing many complaints from listeners who loved cricket but hated politics. 20 years ago, no one would have predicted that cricket commentaries would migrate from radio and television to a live blog on a phone, or that a government would one day be able to bask in the reflected glory of a winning national cricket team.
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Jonathan Coleman.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice in relation to the Black Caps' performance in the Cricket World Cup.
Is there any objection to that course of action being followed? There does appear to be none.
Rather the opposite. MPs queued to join the Minister of Health in celebrating New Zealand's defeat of South Africa in the World Cricket Cup semi-final on Tuesday and wishing them well for the final. The opposition opened its account with a googly from Labour's spokesman on sport, Trevor Mallard.
It is a slightly unusual approach. We normally wait until after the final of these circumstances. But I can see he wanted to get in while the Prime Minister was away.
Also mixing politics and sport, Greens co-leader Matiria Touré had become an overnight fan of Grant Elliott, who hit the winning six off the penultimate ball.
Grant and the Greens share a passion. I learned from Twitter last night that his profile says that he is into energy efficiency and a green future. That makes me doubly proud, and I'd quite happily buy him a coffee any day.
A flat white for a black cap from Matiria Touré, while the New Zealand First Party's Mahesh Bindra detected some divine intervention.
I genuinely thought we were looking at a run chase in the mid-300s. Then God put his black cap on and it rained. I wonder if some babies to be born in 9 months' time will feature Duckworth Lewis in their name.
United Futures' Peter Dunn revealed an ulterior motive for hoping for a win in the final.
There's a bigger challenge ahead on Sunday. If the government saw fit today to move this motion on the semi-final, they may choose to adjourn the House in celebration for the week once we win the final. So go the Black Caps on Sunday.
Peter Dunn was joined in wishing the Black Caps success in the final by the Māori Party's co-leader, Marama Fox.
I don't want to put the hoodie on our team. The hoodie-goody. I don't know what you call it, but that's what we call it. Mr. I don't want to tempt fate, but I want to add my best wishes with everybody else to the Black Caps for the upcoming final. I know we can do it. Go the boys.
Admitting to a limited knowledge of cricket, Marama Fox said she'd watched the match.
And we got to about 10 overs out and I was doing the back of the envelope math and I thought, we can do it. We can do it, New Zealand. I have to admit, I fell asleep. Shame. I know.
Falling asleep watching cricket is not uncommon, whereas forgetting to submit a question for oral answer by a minister is virtually unheard of. That's what Marama Fox's Māori Party did on Wednesday, failing to exercise its right to put questions to ministers. Questions are allocated according to a party's numbers in the House. With two MPs, the Māori Party would have fewer than a dozen questions a year, and will now have to wait about four sitting weeks for the opportunity to hold ministers to account at question time, which ended on Wednesday with this request from Labor's senior whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, the rules of the House allow for the lodging of 12 primary questions in a day. I note that no other member has lodged a 12th question, therefore I seek leave to ask one.
Well, a member can seek leave. Leave is sought to ask an additional question on the basis there's only 11 on the sheet. Is there any objection?
There was. It came from the government benches, of course, where their leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, faced another cheeky request from Mr Hipkins on Thursday.
I wonder whether the Leader of the House can confirm or deny the rumour circulating this afternoon that the government intends to move urgency this afternoon to pass legislation relocating New Zealand's capital back to Russell.
Oh, the Minister can respond if he thinks it's worthy.
No.
But it wasn't all fun and games, as Rhys Lyon reports.
The government got its week in the House off to a flying start, passing 34 bills in just over an hour on Tuesday. Although it'll look good in the record books, the bills were all minor amendments to existing laws, contained in the Statutes Amendment Bill No. 4, an omnibus bill in the works for just over a year, and split into 34 separate bills for their third reading, which included this contribution from National List MP Brett Hudson.
This bill started as an omnibus bill. An omnibus bill is a bill that contains changes across many acts, changes that are generally quite technical in nature and are non-controversial, but are not matters of policy, but matters of small change. And I'm sure that reminder serves us both well, Mr Speaker.
But Mr Speaker, in this case his deputy, Chester Burrows, wasn't that impressed with that information from his National Party colleague.
Just to remind the House that thanks to the contributions from previous speakers, we do know that this is a statutes amendment bill. It amends 34 pieces of legislation. They are non-controversial. It is an omnibus bill. We now know what an omnibus does. And it will be most appreciated by the Chair and others in the House and by those listening if people speak to the provisions of the bill. Thank you.
And while following Mr Burrows' instruction, the next speaker, the Greens' Eugenie Sage, talked about something that wasn't in this statutes amendment bill, which, she noted, was different from other bills.
Because if one single MP opposes it, then it doesn't proceed. And the Green Party exercised that right recently because it was proposed through supplementary order paper number 50 to this bill to change the Members of Parliament Remunerations and Services Act 2013 to increase the travel benefits for MPs that had entered Parliament prior to 1999. And to the Green Party, that looked to be both substantive and controversial, and it had no place in a statutes amendment bill. Therefore, we opposed it, and, Mr Speaker, it's not in the bill.
And so, thanks to Eugenie Sage and the Greens, did not become law when all 34 bills were sent off for the Governor-General's signature without dissent on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, MPs debated the committee stages of three bills: the Social Security Amendment Bill No. 3, the Immigration Amendment Bill No. 2, and the Taxation KiwiSaver Homestart and Remedial Matters Bill. That last one, the Taxation KiwiSaver Homestart and Remedial Matters Bill, was back before the House on Thursday, when it passed its final reading without dissent. And also this week, and outside the chamber, the Prime Minister travelled to South Korea to sign a free trade agreement between New Zealand and the Republic of Korea. That agreement will now undergo Parliament's ratification process, where it is passed into law by way of legislation. Public submissions are now being called, and the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee was briefed on the free trade agreement by Ministry of Foreign Affairs trade negotiator Martin Harvey on Thursday.
Korea is our sixth largest export destination for goods and services and our eighth largest import source. So it's a pretty important country for us to do an FTA with. Total two-way trade is about $4 billion per year.
Mr. Harvey said despite the size of the Korean market, trade opportunities were restricted due to trade tariffs.
Approximately $229 million a year is paid by our exporters or the importers of New Zealand goods into Korea. Sort of on a, I guess, on a dollar export value level, it's one of the highest sort of rates of duties that we pay anywhere in the world.
But once the trade agreement was ratified, all that would change.
Under the FTA, tariff reductions in the first year alone will save an estimated $65 million New Zealand dollars. We're the 13th country to sign an FTA with Korea, so we have been suffering an increasing disadvantage compared to international competitors who already have FTAs, such as the United States and Australia. The FTA will ensure that in the face of these other FTAs, we'll be able to maintain our place in the Korean market and seek to grow our position in the future.
Mr. Harvey was asked by Labour Party committee member David Shearer how the deal stacked up with those struck by other countries.
We're getting quite a lot of benefit from it. Korea's getting virtually none in comparison, to, for example, to the 12 or 13 FTAs that Korea's already signed, and particularly with the United States. How do we rate compared to them?
It compares pretty well with what everybody got. We've done better in some areas, worse in other areas, and that can reflect the relative priorities that we have for particular products. If you look at, beef, the outcome on beef, which is a key export for us, the outcome is the same as the Americans got, the same as the EU got, same as Australia and Canada.
Ministry of Foreign Affairs trade negotiator Martin Harvey with that briefing on the South Korean Free Trade Agreement. And just prior to that item of business on Thursday, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee received a briefing on nuclear disarmament from New Zealand's UN Ambassador for Disarmament, Dal Higgy, who outlined the effectiveness of a 1968 treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons.
It's worked pretty well in terms of non-proliferation, in terms of the number of countries outside the treaty that have acquired nuclear weapons. In the 60s, people were saying, oh, by the end of the century, there'll be 30, 40 countries with nuclear weapons. That hasn't happened. There are, in fact, only nine. So what's called the horizontal proliferation of nuclear weapons has been well constrained.
But Ambassador Higgy said not all countries had signed up to the treaty.
Of the nine that had nuclear weapons, five are inside the treaty, permanent members of the Security Council, and then there are four that have never signed on to the treaty, or three that have never signed on to the treaty, India, Pakistan and Israel, and one, North Korea, that signed on to the treaty and then withdrew. So nine countries have nuclear weapons. It's the bit, the Article 6 bit, about giving up the weapons that you have or moving forward to eliminate them, which is not working well and is now reaching a critical point, and some people assert that it's now at breaking point.
Ambassador Higgy speculated on why that might be.
And it's simply because the five nuclear weapon states are not doing enough to persuade we non-nuclear countries that they do really intend to move to a nuclear-free world. Yes, we had the marvellous Prague vision of President Obama, but there's not been a lot given to flesh that out. There's not a lot that's changed in the period since then to persuade non-nuclear weapon states that the five permanent members really do intend to move forward on the effective measures on nuclear disarmament.
New Zealand's UN Ambassador for Disarmament, Dal Higgy, with that briefing to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Thursday. All up, there were 15 committee meetings held during the week.
That's report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber, the battle between National and Labour over who spent the most on Northland's roads ended inconclusively on Thursday with a final flurry of questions and answers, the latter provided by Transport Minister Simon Bridges.
I would be embarrassed to be asking the sort of questions that he is asking. We have spent...
Order! Honourable Simon.
It was great to see you elicit that kind of excitement from the opposition, Mr. Speaker.
Transport Minister Simon Bridges, who will no doubt be able to stop answering questions about Northland's bridges for a while.
Yes, Saturday's by-election should at least mean an end to the daily questions in the battle between Labour and National over which party spent the most on Northland's roads while in office. As for the effect on Parliament, the official result of the by-election will be declared next Wednesday, April the 8th. The following Monday, April the 13th, is the deadline for any applications for a judicial recount. If there is none, and it was a very clear win for Mr. Peters, the Electoral Commission returns the writs originally issued back in February by the Governor-General, naming the successful candidate. The first chance for the Speaker to inform MPs of the name of Mike Sabin's replacement in the Northland seat will be on Tuesday, April the 28th, when Parliament resumes after this long adjournment. The result will affect the proportional representation of parties in this Parliament. National loses a seat, New Zealand First gains one, but the overall number of seats will remain the same at 121, unless all names remaining on the New Zealand First Party's list are somehow unavailable, not willing or unable, or no longer signed up as members of the party. Mr. Peters cannot hold two seats, an electorate seat and a list seat at the same time, so he must resign from his list seat, and then, by law, the Electoral Commission must go down the list starting at number 12, which is Rhea Bond. It's not up to Mr. Peters to decide. So unless all 13 of the 25 names remaining on his party's list are somehow unavailable, the numbers in the chamber look very much like the last Parliament. And although the talk has been about the government's ability to pass its Resource Management Act reforms, the focus will actually fall every second Wednesday on members' bills and on the member for Oahu, Peter Dunn, because when Mr. Dunn crosses the floor, as he does from time to time, National is left with just the ACT Party's David Seymour to give the government a total of 60 votes, while the opposition with Peter Dunn will have 61. The real politic of this Parliament is a bedrock majority of 61 for National with ACT and United Future. That moves across the chamber with Peter Dunn whenever he supports opposition members' bills, leaving the government reliant on its financial veto to stop them. Among members' bills in the hopper is one from New Zealand First, which would repeal the legislation enshrining the government's deal extending the Sky City Casino's gambling concessions in return for construction of a new convention centre in Auckland. But that won't be coming up until the middle of the year.
Thanks, Tom. Now it's time for the Mystery Voice.
The Week in Parliament Mystery Voice.
When will the Minister come clean with the people of Wellsford, Tahana and Northland generally that the government actually has no route through the Dome Valley?
Who is the mystery voice and what are they talking about? Here it is again.
The Week in Parliament Mystery Voice.
When will the minister come clean with the people of Wellsford, Tahana and Northland generally that the government actually has no route through the Dome Valley?
The identity of the mystery voice will be revealed later in the programme, but first here's Rhys Lyon to report on a long-running dispute over the government's record on climate change.
Greens co-leader Russell Norman put questions about climate change to the Minister for Climate Change Issues.
Does he stand by the Prime Minister's answer that it is quote-unquote misinformation that New Zealand's net greenhouse gas emissions have increased by 20% between 2008 and 2012? And if so, by what percentage did New Zealand's net greenhouse gas emissions increase between 2008 and 2012?
Answering on Tim Gross's behalf was Associate Climate Change Issues Minister Simon Bridges.
On behalf of the Minister, yes, I stand by the Prime Minister's statement in the context in which it was made, and that the member has been highly selective with his data.
Mr Norman then repeated the second part of his primary question.
By what percentage did New Zealand's net greenhouse gas emissions increase between 2008 and 2012?
Well, Honourable Speaker, Simon Bridges.
As the member has said, 20%, but he is being highly selective with his data to the point of being misleading. He is trying to arbitrarily line up climate figures with electoral cycles when, in fact, emissions have no regard to that.
Russell Norman was later rebuked by the Speaker, his lengthy questions apparently causing disorder in the House.
That question is now out of order. It is simply too long. I've warned this member on many, many occasions. He must abide by standing orders. He needs to refer to Standing Order 380. Questions must be concise.
That call from the Speaker only provoked a further point of order from Russell Norman's opposition colleague, Labour's David Parker.
That same ruling or standing order applies to answers, sir, and I would ask that you apply the same ruling to answers, particularly from Mr Joyce.
Order. And that is an... Order! That is a reasonable point. If where I allow longer answers is when we get a very long, lengthy question with a lot of political innuendo. But generally speaking, answers should also, as the Honourable David Parker point out, be in accordance with standing orders. Is there a fresh point of order?
That is an explanation sometimes in respect of opposition questions, but the length is also apparent on the government's own questions to their own ministers.
I will address it on the occasion.
And Mr Norman had a complaint of his own.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. You have repeatedly during this session said that if my questions cause disorder, then you will say that's a problem. The disorder comes because Mr Brownlee starts shouting in Parliament instead of listening to the question.
Member will resume his seat. The disorder comes because the question is simply too long and it's full of imputation and allegations. If the member would go back to his office and practice short, concise questions, he would make far more progress.
Speaker David Carter.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Now back to the Mystery Voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery Voice.
When will the Minister come clean with the people of Wellsford, Tahana and Northland generally that the government actually has no route through the Dome Valley?
Supplementary question, Dennis O'Rourke.
When will the Minister come clean with the people of Wellsford, Tahana and Northland generally that the government actually has no route through the Dome Valley and no idea whatsoever when construction could begin on the Wellsford to Warkworth section of the new motorway?
Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr Speaker, the member is talking nonsense. We've been over this last week and it's old news. I won't rehearse the arguments, Mr Speaker. Suffice to say, we know that on this side of the House, we back the regions with hundreds, in fact billions of dollars worth of projects that matter in those regions. We're on this side, all we hear is carping because outside of two or three main cities, they don't care.
Point of order. Dennis O'Rourke.
Mr Speaker, this question was specifically about...
Member will resume his seat. I've got a very good mind to ask that member to leave the chamber, but I won't because he'll get an advantage on the rest of us to actually watch the cricket. But the member's question, when the member starts a question, why won't the minister come clean, he can expect the sort of answer he got. It'd be better after question time to go back and make his questions far more concise without that sort of innuendo. Question number 8.
And that's all we have time for. More information and a podcast of this program on our webpage, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Hanea Ahu and I'll be back with Tom Frewen and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.